Hey, this is Dave Pryor. Welcome to the Reluctant Agilist. Scott Selhurst is back. Scott, thank you for making time for this today.
So great. I always love hanging out with you, Dave.
I do too. I told my daughter right before I came into the room, like, I'm going to go do a podcast with a guy whose brain runs circles around me. So I'm very excited to be lapped for this conversation.
Well, hell, that's not going to happen. We're going to talk about places where I've been more than you've been. That's all.
Okay. That's fair. So before we jump into the topic, which the topic is going to be improving the product plan while executing the plan, we're going to talk all about how to know what stuff to do. Would you mind kind of walking the folks through the work that you do in Tyner Bain and your kind of general aim and how you're trying to save the world from itself?
Yeah. So I'm a product management and strategy consultant. And so then the question becomes, what the heck does that mean? There's a few different things, but basically I'm helping companies and the people in those companies get better at building better products. The tagline on the Tyner Bain website is, or at least used to be, probably still is, build the right things right. And so, right, there's all of these execution and quality level, how do you get good at building stuff, things, which my DNA and my undergrad degree are in engineering. So, right, that suits me.
Yeah.
But you have to make choices to build the right things or it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Okay. Which is a great segue into the on-ramp for our conversation. So I'm going to present something that happens to me frequently in the CSPO class. In the CSPO class, the way it works is the students define a problem to solve with a product or service. They go through a couple rounds of vision statements, and then they build a product roadmap. And the thing that happens 95% of the time in these classes is they build out their roadmap. And like I say, what can you do in the next week? And they all go straight into execution. Without any consideration of what they should do first, why they should do first, what the customer wants. There's no exploration of any of that. So I want to kind of start there and see, you know, what you would say to, if you saw people just automatic, not that this would ever happen in the real world, but that companies might just start building stuff without figuring out what they should build.
Yes. That's the world we live in. Every client I've worked with since I started consulting on my own in 2005 has had that problem. And it's one way to think about it is when the fear of being late dwarfs the fear of being wrong, people jump to action and it doesn't, they're not worried about whether or not they're building the right things. They're worrying about being idle or not being first.
So a little behind the scenes note, what's awesome about doing podcasts with Scott is as he started to say that, I was writing down the question, why do they have the problem? And he was already answering it.
Yay. Great, Scott. Point for me.
So how do you kind of coax them into like calming down and trying to figure out, it's sort of like the whole lean startup thing, right? Figure out what people want before you start trying to force it to them.
Yeah. Well, yes. So the easiest way to explain it is not the way I would say it from a bedside manner point of view, but when somebody says, hey, here's my backlog, I'd say, why are you building that? Why are you building that? I don't know. Why that? Well, what do you think is going to happen if you build that? And those are genuinely hard questions when you're anchored on what you're trying to build. That right, that sort of build it and they will come thing. We all know that.
Yeah, you're broken. Committed to the answer.
But yeah, you're exactly. You're committed to the answer and you haven't identified the question yet. And
it's too scary to be wrong.
And that's part of teasing the things back out. There's something I do for clients called a backlog rationalization workshop, where I will come in and look at all of those things that are right stacked up. Had one client that had a 2.5 year deep backlog, right? All of the work estimated versus the size of their team, 2.5 years deep. We threw away at the end of this 1 week workshop, we threw away 80% of that backlog. So we cut the cost by 80%, and based on what we were able to do in the workshop, we believe we cut the value by about 20%.
That's a really important thing. So can you hit that one again just to make sure everybody got it?
Yeah.
You took out how much of the work?
We took 81%, but we took out 80% of the work, right? Based on the estimate. So everything could be a little bit long, but it was 80%.
Yeah.
And based on what we think the value from all of those work items were, which we teased out during this workshop, we cut about 20% of the value.
So that's like a really topsy-turvy Pareto version there.
Yeah, it matched Pareto, which really kind of freaked me out. Because I didn't expect it to. I just knew that there were a lot of bad ideas and there were a lot of good ideas. And we took the team that was underwater with this effectively infinite slog in front of them, and we pulled out all the stuff that wasn't going to matter and got them into something approachable, attackable, addressable, and put them in a position to be able to now field new ideas. Like
so it gives them freedom when you take a lot of that stuff away. I mean, there's a feeling of loss, but you're actually giving them more oxygen.
Yeah. Freedom. And I would say agency too, because the way they got to 2.5 years is all these ideas coming in all the time and no way to compare the ideas. It was build this, build that, build that, build that. How do I, the only way for something to make it to the top of the list is if whoever's asking for it has a lot of juice.
Well, so with what you just said, I'm thinking of me like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago at the Agile conference doing podcast, the question I would have asked would be, how do you determine the relative value of the items to decide what to do? But with the stuff you said at the beginning of this call, I'm thinking it's really fear driven, right? I mean, they're afraid to ask. It's like there's a dark room. They know they should look in, but they're scared to. There's some part of their brain that knows they're not sure about the problem, but everybody thinks they're Steve Jobs, so they're just going to be right and they're going to brute force their way through it. Is it a value thing or is it a fear thing?
It's a value thing. It's two kinds of value and two kinds of fear. Now, I don't know if I'll get all the way through all four of those things, but the two kinds of value are value to the customer and value to the business. And the two kinds of fear are the fear of that product person making, building that backlog, designing that roadmap, and the fear of the people around them telling them what to do. So those are my four different things. Like those, from a sociological point of view, there are all of these abstract worries that get translated into mandates and dictates of go build this stuff and build it yesterday.
Yeah.
And they're kind of stuck, unless we give them some tools to develop some agency, they're kind of stuck just reacting to that because the requests aren't coming from the newest hires, right? The requests are coming from the most senior people. And so you have to change how you do stuff in the system to be able to address that fear. The internal fear is the thing that I really poke on when I'm doing training and workshops and coaching with individual product people is what we're trying to do is move from a zone of control. I'm going to build this, then I'm going to build that, then I'm going to build that. I can control that backlog of features, right? I can control the factory. And we're trying to move from, did I finish the work? And if it took longer, I can add extra people or I can work overtime or I can change the schedule. I am fully in control whether or not I succeed. I'm never out of control. And that's a comfortable place to be. So the fear for, I'll say, the product manager who's building that roadmap is, We're asking them, we need them to move out of that zone of control and into the sphere of influence where they cannot control. Because I love value proposition as a term. Like we all know, the value proposition. What we are saying is we're going to build this thing and we are proposing that it's valuable to you. That's the essence of the value prop. And what we're saying is we can control what we build. We can't control whether or not customers need it. We can't control whether or not they get value from it. We can't control whether or not the company makes money because we built it. All we can do is influence those things.
How do you influence them? That's part, I'm super curious about this.
So everything you build, once you shift from this feature factory mindset into an outcome orientation, you are building it because you think it's going to solve a problem that provides value to a customer in a way that will provide value to the company.
Like learning or whatever.
Learning.
But I guess it could be anything. Revenue. It could be revenue, could be whatever.
Yeah. Like let's say with an e-commerce website. So I did work with Zappos a dozen years ago. And one of the things we were looking at was Zappos doesn't just sell shoes. They sell outfits. They sell tops and pants and shoes and belts and accessories and all that kind of stuff. And one of the challenges is when somebody finds a lovely top, they will have a difficult time finding the right accessories and bottoms and shoes to go with that top to make an outfit. And they're not there necessarily to buy a top. They're there to create an outfit or to create a look or whatever. Like there's all of these different reasons why somebody's there.
Yeah.
But so from Zappos's point of view, it was like, how do we build something that helps them, that makes it easier for them to find things that go well with that top?
How do you Garanimal the whole thing?
Yeah. 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 Garanimal's the solution for the busy soccer mom.
You young people can look that one up.
Yeah. Yeah. The busy soccer mom, Garanimal's is the solution for that for sure. Pre-e-commerce. And so you say, okay, well, we're creating value for that customer, making it easier for them to find the outfit, which was the whole reason they were shopping for the blouse in the first place.
Right.
Then it's, well, we'll make more money because they'll buy the top from us and they'll buy the bottoms from us and they'll buy the belt from us.
So the influence is a suggestive upsell.
It's, well, in this case, what we're doing is we're building something that makes it easier for them to do that. That doesn't mean they're going to do it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So all we can do is, and whatever
you're removing all the reasons not to, so that they really have nothing else left to do but to buy.
Right. And if we don't do a good job building something, it's not going to change their behavior.
Yeah.
Right. So if we build something that recommends, I'll say heavy wool pants for a light sleeveless blouse, that's probably not going to work because you wouldn't wear them at the same time.
Well, you might not.
Yeah, very, very true. I would not. So we could build it poorly, right? So the recommendation engine or whatever doesn't do a good job. Or we could build the wrong thing where the issue isn't that they don't know what they want. The issue is that it's too expensive to get it all at once.
Or they can't find
it. Whatever it is. It's some other problem. Yeah. We don't know what it is. So we're in control of what we build to try and solve a problem. But we might pick the wrong problem and we might not do a good job solving it. So we can only influence whether or not it was actually better for that customer. And that's that first piece. The second piece we have to lean in.
Hang on before you do the second part.
Okay.
I just wanted to say some of this back and make sure I'm sorted on it. So one way to look at this is you want them to do something. You've a hypothesis you want to test. Let's remove as many of these breaking points or barriers or clicks or whatever it is, all these reasons they could bail and not do the thing we want them to do. You're trying to eliminate as much as possible so that you can figure out, is this the problem you have to solve? Or is it teaching you, oh, nope, it's not that one. It's another one.
It's those things. Is eliminate as much as possible or eliminate the biggest barrier.
Yeah.
Or learn something, right? By trying something and finding out it doesn't work. And hypothesis is the right word. This is the solution hypothesis. I create a thing, it solves this problem or addresses a need is the language I use when I'm being pedantic, and it'll cause some observable change. So we're asking people, instead of focusing on I'm building this thing, focus on I'm trying to create this change by solving a problem. And so that instead of giving you the comfort of focusing on the thing you can control, now you're uncomfortably focused on the thing you're trying to influence. And maybe it'll work and maybe it won't work, but now you're holding yourself accountable to something you can't control. And that's super uncomfortable. And that's the fear for that product person or the fear for the team working right, collaboratively, product design, engineering, QA, working together, all for the same reason.
So real life scenario, I'm in a situation where I need people to sign up for classes. There are people who compete on price. I'm not one of them. But I want to change behavior where people are not just pursuing the lowest possible price point, where they're pursuing all the other factors they should be considering when they take a class or sign up for a class. But I have to run experiments to figure out which of those problems that I see is a problem that resonates with them. And then how can I solve it, right?
Absolutely. Do you want to solve the problem of, am I building a network with other people taking the class where we connect and bond? Am I solving the problem of this schedule is super convenient for me? Am I solving the problem of it's easy to get my company to pay for it? Am I solving the problem of it uses examples that are immediately applicable in my particular domain or area of business? Like it's all healthcare centered or it's all AI.
Can a product company choose? I'll stick with my example for a second. There are trainers who compete on price. There are people that buy on price. But is it possible if you have a product to pursue a problem other than the one that seems to be the most obvious one?
I have a
cruise ship and I want people to buy rooms on my cruise ship and go on my cruise. And there's other places that are going to give you like all these free drinks and compete on price, but I want to compete on service and experience and personalization. So I can carve out a market. If I can find the levers to pull, I can scrape out a separate market for myself to pursue, right?
Yes. In that case, what you're solving different problems, which in your example means you're probably looking for different people.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Okay. So when you're working with companies and they're trying to do this, like how do you get them to figure out which questions to ask and then figure out which ones to start running experiments on?
Yeah.
Is that the next place to go? Because I know I cut you off before you were going to go through another thing.
No.
And I promised to not be the one that took us off the rails.
Yes. And it depends on which conversation I'm having in the moment. So when I was at HP, I came in supporting the global head of software. So it was a top-down set of conversations. And I've also worked with clients where I was coming in more at the team level and bottoms-upping it, right, within the context like a broader transformation or something. And the top-down questions are the ones that make it make sense. And so like it's probably a great way for us to talk about it today because it just kind of all fits together. But the reality is you have to work it bottoms up, which it's the difference between theory and practice, maybe. The theory is the top-down view of we have a direction we're going in. The company has an identity or a company brand, who they're trying to be. And against that, that says we're going to try and solve problems in this market. And they're going to pick a market. And they're going to pick a set of problems within that market. And then they're going to say, who are the people who care the most about those problems? That's who we're going to help. And you start with that anchor and say, okay, well, what do we need to build to help them? Perfect question.
But you don't even know but don't you have to figure out if they think they have the problem you think they have?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, you should. But then how much of that do you do? Because it's a gradient, right? You can just try something where you have no idea at all. You have no reason to believe why your idea might be a good one. Or you could research forever. And by the time you really get it dialed in, those people have moved on. They don't care about that problem.
So there's some sweet spot in the middle. Or there's a spot in the middle where you're like, all right, we have enough. Let's start running tests. Right?
Yes. And here's the here's the neat thing about sort of that transition into in practice. When you've got a product plan, and whether it's your release plan, your product roadmap, or whatever, like, so I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but just say the things we're planning to do with our product over the next 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, right? Whatever, the product plan, we're taking this approach. When you've got that, it isn't, your level of understanding isn't the same across all of those different moving pieces. There are some things where you're really dialed in. Like you know, you've done ride-alongs in customer service. You've heard people call back. You know with a high degree of confidence.
That this is a problem.
That this is a problem and people want to solve it. And there's stuff in there that you're just trying some stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe an executive was at a conference and saw a display and said, oh, wow, we should do that too. Or maybe sales guy said, I was talking to a client and we can't close this deal unless you do that thing.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, right? You've got this sort of continuum mm-hmm. of uncertainty about whether or not every one of those ideas is a good one.
Okay.
And there's an old joke that says 50% of the marketing budget is wasted. The problem is we don't know which 50%.
Right.
Product management, it's the same thing, right? You've got this product plan.
Yeah.
Some of that plan is a bad idea, right? All the old stats were like 80% of features don't get used. Maybe 80% of your product plan is a bad idea.
But then how are you, but how is a product person or a company supposed to know without building the thing? Like I don't know if you're going to want to eat my cheeseburger that's made with a soft, gushy chocolate mayonnaise center or not until I try to feed it to you.
Right, but you don't have to convert the kitchen and make that the only kind of burger you sell, like lean into it as some sort of gourmet In-N-Out burger where all of your burgers have chocolate mayonnaise. And that's all you've got, and that's all you sell. You can do some experimentation, you can do some market research. The thing is, you don't have enough time, right? Well, you'll run into the heat death of the universe to test everything all the way to that degree of
you're never going to be 100% sure.
That feels like control. And even if you could, you can't, because everything you learned yesterday. And everything you're selling tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah.
And so it's impossible. So you have to embrace that you're operating in an environment of uncertainty.
Okay.
And I like the distinction of uncertainty versus risk. I think it's fundamental.
Oh, okay. I'm curious about this. Because I always say that the product owner is always at risk. Like you have to, that's your life when you're a product owner.
Yeah. Here's an example I used with a former student for explaining the difference. And I said to him, okay, if you give me $20 and send me into the casino to place a bet on the roulette wheel, that's risk. You know the odds. You trust me, right? I'm going to do exactly what you said.
Yeah.
And you know the odds, and that's risk. And there's a 5.26% house advantage on that roulette wheel in America where you have zero and double zero. And you know the odds, and you know it's a risk, and you place the bet. Mm-hmm. Uncertainty is you put the money in an envelope and you give it to me on my way into the casino, but you don't know which game I'm going to play. You don't know if I'm going
to play. Or if you're going to play one at all.
Yeah, I guess you could take, yes.
I mean, couldn't you just walk back out 20 minutes later and be like, yeah, we broke even.
Yeah, see, Dave, now you're channeling my daughter, the lawyer, right? Because she would go down that thread too. But let's say I'm going to play a game, but you don't know if I'm going to play roulette. You don't know if I'm going to play odds, Baccarat
slots.
Or whatever, right? You have no idea. Yeah. And so you're going to get some money back at the end, maybe.
Maybe.
In the first one, you know the odds, so it's risk. In the second one, not only do you not know the odds, you don't even know the rules.
Okay.
And that's the world we live in product management. when or just building products, product development in general.
Sure.
We don't know what it is. We don't know what we don't know. We don't know if the competitors are going to do something that's way better than what we're planning and launch it the week before. We don't know if our customers are going to stop caring. We don't know if they're going to find our approach unappetizing. Like all of these different things could go wrong. And you could never run out of a list of all the things you don't understand. So you really need to think about uncertainty. And so you need to have that headspace when saying, how do I fix the plan? Because what you're going to do, and this is where David Bland and Steve Blank and like lean startup folks, right, lean into the, we need this culture of experimentation. And I'm like, great. Yes, absolutely. Experimentation, market research. We want to do stuff to learn where we don't understand, where we do, you know, we want to remove unknowns, but we don't have the capacity to learn everything we want to learn about all of the unknowns. So
if you went into the casino with $20 and wanted to test the risk of each different game, you'd be out of money before you had finished your experiments.
Right. Right. You can't get there. And so, so then it becomes, how do I know what to test first? Mm-hmm. And then this is where that marketing budget metaphor really locks into me is in your product plan, there are these hot spots of jeopardy and you don't know where they are. So approach your product plan in a way that shows you where they are and then use that as your signal. And my definition of jeopardy is very specific. It is the combination of uncertainty and sensitivity. Where are we most likely to be wrong? And where do things go off the rails the hardest when we're wrong? Where does it hurt the most if we're wrong?
Okay.
Right. So like with your chocolate mayonnaise burgers.
Yeah, yeah.
If your plan was we're going to introduce this as a secret off menu item for people who follow us on Instagram, that's very low risk. Right. You can have one of your cooks have a jar of chocolate mayo. Right. And if somebody orders it,
you artisan hand spun chocolate mayo, I'd say.
Yeah, my bad. Hand spun chocolate mayo. Right. You could have that available. And if somebody saw it on Instagram, thought it sounded good and came in and tried it, you would make it for them. But the rest of your business is effectively unaffected.
So my brand is safe. My business is safe.
There's very little sensitivity to being wrong. If this hand-spun chocolate mayo idea is a bad one, it's not going to mess you up.
Right.
But if your plan was we're opening right next to another burger shop and we can't compete with them on price or burger quality, so we're going to compete on novelty. And the only thing we have is chocolate mayo.
Yeah.
If you're wrong, you're toast.
Well, I'm stuck now on Starbucks because when I worked at the first Starbucks in New York City, and when they were in their big boom phase, they would only put a Starbucks in a neighborhood where there was already a high-end coffee shop. So I guess their biggest fear is they're going to put a Starbucks in a place where people aren't going to have a palate for what they want to offer or the wallet to pay for what they want to offer. So they're reducing their uncertainty by putting it in a neighborhood where they already have it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. They avoided the expense of doing catchment area analysis to see, right. They took the exact opposite approach that like Walmart took when they expanded, where they looked and said, where are the places that are underserved?
No, yeah.
And that's where we're going to go in.
Okay. All right. So I'm really hung up on this uncertainty and sensitivity thing. So how do you define that? Like if I'm, how do you measure it? How do you quantify it?
Yeah. Okay. So the frame, I'll talk about the frame.
For how do you not think of it as, I just keep thinking about marriage. Like everything is uncertainty and sensitivity. So,
yeah. So how do you see it? You need to be able to see it before you can quantify it.
Okay.
And there's two things. The thing you fundamentally do is you build an impact map. And I found a picture of the first impact map I built in 2013, right after Goico released the book. And I've evolved how I use them since then and changed it a little bit, right? To make it more focused, really to solve this problem, because this problem is inescapable.
And I'm going to include a link to the other, we did a podcast a long time ago about impact mapping. So I'll make sure I include a link to that one.
Oh, goodness.
But can you give like a brief explanation of what it is
sure.
for folks that are listening?
Sure. I'll read it right to left. I'll read it backwards because that's probably where people are. There's all these things we need to build. And everything you build, you're building it to address a need. Because here's this problem we're trying to solve, right? I'm not getting good attach rates. Customers can't build their bundles. The process is too slow. Whatever it is, there's some problem you're trying to solve. Here's the things we need to build to solve it. So everything connects to a need. And you can say anything that doesn't have a need, I don't need to build it, right? Which is really kind of handy. But everything connects to a need. And then here's the thing that is where you shift. You can choose to solve those problems, but what you need to do is shift to, if I address that need, what do I think changes?
Okay.
Will the average order size go up? Will the process time shorten? Will
if we offer oat milk in their coffee, will we get more customers or more sales?
Yes. Yeah. Will increase the average order size? Would be a great way to look at it, right? Because you can immediately get that feedback. And then the next step is, these are the changes I'm trying to create in the world around me. I solve these problems. They cause changes. I get this nice tight feedback loop that, right, the whole startup world loves, because now I can do my experimentation. I can try something, see if it worked. If it didn't work, try something else. Like, that whole world lives right there. But then the next question is this shift into business model. If I increase average order size, will I make more money? Or will people buy less frequently? It's not a sure thing.
Okay. Yeah.
So there is an outcome. These are the changes we're trying to create. Get more customers in the door, increase the order size, sell products, upsell into products at a higher price point, or that products where we get a higher margin or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the input to another hypothesis. But now we're not in that engineering realm. We're in the business realm. If I can do that, then we make more money.
So you buy the blouse, and either I'm going to offer you like shoes, pants, or like whatever, like a whole outfit. But then they're spending more money all at once, but they get the whole outfit. Or maybe you realize that if they buy these things one at a time, like one thing every day or every other day, they're spending less money for each transaction, and the cost appears for them to be less of an issue.
Yes. And this stuff gets really, really hard. Like, so like, let me use your replay of my earlier example, right? They see the blouse, they buy the shoes. If I'm observing changes in behavior, there's three things that are going to happen. So we'll narrow it down to only the people who were buying the blouse, right? Everybody wasn't going to buy anything. We don't have to worry about them. We can, it's like,
it don't matter.
It's like design of experiments from high school, right? We can isolate that stuff. So the people who bought the blouse, some of them were going to buy the shoes no matter what, even though it was hard to find them, they were going to find them and buy them.
Yep.
Some of them were not going to buy the shoes, no matter what.
Yeah.
There's only this little third population in the middle, this third population in the middle who, if we make it easier, they will buy the shoes. And if we don't make it easier, they won't. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have to narrow in on, is that's the change we're creating.
Okay.
And that starts to get really uncomfortable. Because it's really easy to think about, I'm going to build this recommendation engine that says, for all the people who bought this blouse, who also bought shoes, the most frequently purchased pair of shoes purchased at the same time is this one. So I'm going to put that and say, hey, do you need these shoes? right on the website whenever anybody adds the, you know, looks at the blouse or adds it to their shopping cart or whatever, right? Which,
okay.
That's your first hypothesis. And you're making these connections. You're saying the reason they don't buy the shoes is it's hard to find them. That might be the reason. It might not be the reason. And you're saying, if it's hard to find them, I can build some recommendation engine that crunches the numbers based on our history of sales and recommend the right set of shoes. That's another connection.
Okay.
Each one of those connections is depicting a causal relationship.
Sure.
I build the engine, help solve the problem of find the shoes, people will buy the shoes.
Then I had one more facing of Rice Krispies on the cereal shelf in the supermarket. I'm going to see an increase by X amount. They actually know that in the supermarket.
Put the marshmallow cream jar right next to the Rice Krispies.
The mayonnaise. The chocolate right next to the mayonnaise. It's a perfect pair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got that connection. And then here's the way you do sensitivity is to say, okay, I can make these connections. They feel logical. That's really pretty easy. The question, the hard work is to quantify it.
Like, where's the tipping point?
If I add this engine, solves the problem of people can't find the shoes, gonna cause an increase of people buying the shoes with the blouse, how big of an increase? Mm-hmm. Is it 1% of blouse buyers are gonna also buy the shoes? Is it 10%?
Okay.
How many people are buying the blouse to complete an outfit that they already have built? How many people are buying the blouse, and that's the tip of the spear for a completely new outfit?
Okay.
How many people just...
So there's there's an endless number of permutations you could come up with for this stuff.
Yeah. So you estimate what you think it is.
Estimate in what way?
Well, the very first thing, and everybody can start this right now, say, this is what I think it is.
Okay.
I think it's 5%.
I think if I can reduce the speed of transaction by this many milliseconds, we'll have this many more sales.
Yeah. At Zappos, we had data about page load time versus shopping cart abandonment. So, right. So think back 2010, 2012, right? How quickly the page loads was a real engineering problem. Like, this is when all the content distribution networks were being built out, and Google had data that said faster page loads result in less page abandonment.
But now I'm assuming that you could have if you could decide how fast you wanted the page to load, I want it to load slow enough so that they get to see all the other ads on the page before they can do anything.
You can do that trade-off.
Because there's some sweet spot in there you could try to find.
Yep. And lots of people sort of did bit twiddling about saying, how do I build a page so that it loads my product first and my tracking pixel last? Because that's really slow. So that people can see and interact and not wait on all of my infrastructure. Yeah, that's a real solvable problem. But you've got a hypothesis that says, if I speed it up, then I have more people go further through the funnel.
Okay.
And but you can't just getting more people through the funnel. You can't just translate that. If I increase site time by 10%, I'm not going to increase revenue by 10%.
Right.
Because you have to be thoughtful and say, you know what? I have committed buyers. I have looky-loos.
Yeah. Well, that's that sensitivity thing, right?
Well, part of it
ties back to that.
Yeah. Okay. So you may not get the money out of it. So you put the numbers on based on your beliefs, and then you can then say, based on those numbers, here is my sensitivity. This is how sensitive I am to being wrong.
Okay. In the same way that a person, I'm just trying to think of all these different examples of this. I take a bunch of vitamins, and some of those vitamins I could cut out and I know I would have no discernible difference at all. Other ones I could cut out and I would feel it immediately. But figuring out which ones are which, that's the thing that I would be testing. Right?
Yes. Yes. And so what you're doing is you're coming in with an untested point of view at the beginning that says turmeric is really important for me and boron is not.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so I cut out the turmeric and I'm walking around like all over the place. And I realize, oh, I need some turmeric.
Yep.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So that's your sensitivity. And then, then the uncertainty, I developed a tool I call the confidence rubric back when we were working at Ford, back when we both had the same employer. And I don't care about how confident you are in your beliefs. Oh, I think it's going to be 20%. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be 80%, whatever. I don't care. What I care about is the justification for your confidence.
Okay.
Is your confidence based on testing data?
Okay.
Do you have data that tells you this is exactly what it is? You've got experimental test results. You did your Instagram post. People came in, they tried it, they said this is awesome. But you didn't change the whole menu.
So on the one hand, we've got actual data. On the other hand, I talked to my neighbor Bob at the barbecue over the weekend. Now, they both have me very convinced, but how does that affect how you're looking at it?
Right. And so this is why I developed the rubric. One of the things we learned from the researchers, and this is, again, why I lean into uncertainty versus risk. In risk, you can do this sort of econometric, probabilistic math. What's your expected value? What's your net present value? That kind of stuff. In uncertainty, you can't do that because you don't know the rules. Right? The guy who gave me $20 to bet on roulette, he could calculate the expected value that his $20 was going to be worth $18.87. That's the expected value. When he put it in an envelope and handed it to me, he can't do that calculation.
Okay.
And that's the world we live in uncertainty. What we've learned is that applying decision-making heuristics in an environment of uncertainty is more likely, is a more effective predictor of success than trying to do the expected value calculations.
Okay.
And so I built this heuristic where I take this confidence rubric as a score from 0 to 5, based on the justification for your confidence, however confident you are. At zero, it's let's just try something.
Okay.
Right? It's a random idea. It came out of nowhere. Right? There is no external justification for expecting it to work. So it's a zero.
Okay. And so does that mean you're going to test that later on?
Well, it means it is the most likely to be wrong of all the ideas in your plan.
So that would kind of wave you off of it, right?
It would make you really want to test it.
Ah, okay. So this is where I'm hoping we can – the thing that I'm kind of trying to get towards is let's say I have a whole bunch of these ideas, hypotheses, whatever you want to call them, a backlog of them.
Yep.
How do I know which one to pursue first?
It's the one where you are most likely to be wrong and where it hurts the most when you're wrong.
Okay.
So the combination.
So if I had like quadrants, one would be like certainty, uncertainty, and the other would be like extinction level event, doesn't matter at all.
Right. So very uncertain, critical to get it right. That's the experiment you want to run.
Okay.
Like when we talked to, I first heard this from Jeff Patton way back in the day, right? Build to learn versus build to earn. Build to learn is what you do when you have no idea and it's really important that you get it right.
Okay.
Those are the those are the hot spots of jeopardy in your plan. Those are the experiments you run.
Okay.
So like that's a workshop that I run to lay out the plan, all right, create all those little connections. I think this thing solves that problem. It'll cause this change and here's how we make money. And then look at all of those connections and say, How justified are we in believing that connection? Do we have correlated data? Did we do a bunch of research? Do we have test results? Is it an expert's intuition? Like all of these different reasons why we think that connection exists.
Yeah.
And then how strong of a connection is it?
Okay. And for people that are not doing this stuff or that are resistant to it, I mean, everybody in product development wants some kind of magic future telling machine that says, this is going to work, this is not going to work, which they're never going to have that certainty. But this kind of approach lets you get just a little bit more certain every day that you're at least aiming in the right direction, right?
Yeah. And what I really like about this approach is you can use it right now and do almost no experimentation and research because you're already doing it right now, right? When you just have the flat backlog, which is all these items we're going to build, they're sorted by some, I don't know, alphabetically, some arbitrary order. Mm-hmm. The question becomes, what experiment do I run? And you're like, well, I don't know. And so you don't run the experiments. If you lay it out.
So you don't run them because you don't know.
You don't know which ones to run.
Okay.
So
you're not going to run anything.
So you're not going to run any. So like at a minimum, you can just change it to this way of viewing things. All those items in the backlog are solving these problems that we know we're trying to solve with them. And it'll cause these changes that we expect to see if we solve those problems. And it leads to this much revenue, right? So you build that connective tissue, that cause and effect map. Now you have the option to test stuff. You don't have to test it.
Okay.
But you have a way to answer the question, what should I test first? And let's say you're really, really scared of being late and you're not super scared about being wrong.
Okay.
Maybe you put 5% of your time, 2 hours a week, into trying to get smarter.
Okay.
This now gives you a roadmap to say, what should I, with my very limited capacity, what should I try and get smarter about? I haven't materially changed my product operations. I'm going to be just as efficient. I'm going to get just as much stuff done.
Yeah.
But I'm taking the thing that's most likely to be a complete waste of time and getting smarter about it, which might confirm that it's really important or might help me realize that it's just a stupid idea and I can throw it away.
So I'm going to dumb it down to personal level for a second, because you said about getting smarter, it kind of triggered something for me. I have an evening free, got nothing planned, do whatever I want, lots of different interests. I've got a Deming book right here next to my desk. I really would like to read that, you know, or there's a Denning book right next to the Deming book. Both of these books I want to read, and I could spend my time doing that, and I'd probably get smarter, but I also know that I'm going to be kind of choking on some of the information too, or I'm assuming I would. Or I could pick up my guitar and learn to play another Robert Johnson song, which I'll learn that faster. I will get information quicker. So I'm trying to decide what's the better use of my time. If I want to get smarter, either one of those things could make me smarter, but which one will have a deeper impact on me overall?
So
does that work?
Yeah. So you're moving towards,
I'm thinking about a company can place lots of bets. They can explore lots of different avenues. How do they know which one to go after? Is it too much of a stretch?
No, that's just the next level up. This is around.
I went the wrong way.
I've decided what to go after, right? I've decided what to go after. What's the right way to do it?
So, okay, I want to learn a language. What's the right way to learn the language?
Yeah.
Should I learn a language or should I learn to paint?
Yeah. So like, let's say immersion learning. I'm going to go to China and I'm going to hang out there and learn the language.
Or starve to death.
Very, very high risk.
Yeah.
Right. Because if it doesn't work, you're in China now and not in New York.
Yeah.
An alternative approach would be, I'm going to go hang out in Chinatown every day.
Yeah.
Much lower risk.
Yeah.
Maybe less effective, but much lower risk. Okay. And then I'm just going to pop up Duolingo for Cantonese or some obscure dialect of the minority language spoken in China. But I'm going to play with it on Duolingo, and I'm going to dedicate 15 minutes a day. Maybe even less chance of success, but way lower risk, right? You're not betting the farm.
And those lower risk bets could lead you to a point where you have enough information to say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to China.
Yeah. Yeah, could be.
Okay. And so companies are going to be trying. I hope people are tracking this. I appreciate you tolerating me jumping around. A company developing a product is doing the same kind of thing, putting a toe in, figuring out if the water is the right temperature, and then they can jump all the way in. But we don't want them to just jump all the way in and find out that the water is like 5 degrees or frozen solid or boiling hot.
Yeah. Right. And there's a couple layers of that. One of them is, am I jumping in the market in terms of I launched this new product, like the Segway, if you remember that.
Oh, they're going to build cities around it.
Yeah, they're going to build cities around it, right? So they stayed super stealth all the way. They put all their chips, they went all in on the launch. You can roll it back a little bit. I mean, they still do Segway tours in Austin. I've seen them.
Right around the mall.
yeah, mall cops. But even think about steps short of that, which is I am dedicating my entire team for a year, for 3 years, for 5 years, for 10 years to some pursuit, right? That's the opportunity cost bet, right? We're not even talking about did it fail as a company in the market or whatever, but just rather I have limited capacity and lots of things I want to try and do. How much of that am I willing to lock up?
Okay.
Without getting smarter first.
And then as they're working on it, they're going to be constantly running more. It's not like you run out of experiments. They're going to keep building that backlog and keep changing the plan as they go because they're iterating and getting smarter and learning every day. And maybe you never get all the way to like perfect knowledge.
You definitely never
get smarter every day.
Definitely never.
A little bit smarter every day.
Yep. So the marching order is what's the next most important thing to learn? I've got a plan in front of me, and I've accepted the truism, it's laws of physics, that there is stuff in that plan which is wrong. I just don't know which parts are wrong, and I don't know how wrong they are, but I know that something in it is wrong. And so while I'm executing on that plan, I'm also improving the plan in parallel.
Okay.
That's the thing I teach and help teams do.
Yeah. So I'm changing the name of this podcast
episode
to what's the next most important thing to learn?
See, now that's a great name.
Because it not only applies at a company level, I'm thinking about like I have all these different techniques for prioritizing my stuff on a daily basis, depending on what I'm trying to get out of the day. But a situation I'm facing right now, which you're aware of, like that, this is a really good prioritization technique. Get up in the morning. Okay, what do I have to learn first today? And use that to drive the other actions. This is awesome. So you run workshops in this stuff. I know you're working on a book. They have the blog. Like how would you like people to connect with you?
Reaching out to me on LinkedIn is the easiest way.
Okay.
And whenever I'm doing something somewhere else, I try and make sure to promote it on LinkedIn.
It's on LinkedIn.
Following me on LinkedIn, if you're like, oh, this was great. I don't have anything today, but I want to know when something pops up. Just follow me on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way to do it.
And also, Scott has an awesome blog which he always posts about on LinkedIn. And I think two or three times I have posted a response to one of your blog posts that said my brain exploded. And I've done it so many times that the last time I did it, he called me out on it and said, this can't keep happening. But it's really super insightful stuff. So I'm grateful for your work and for you taking the time with us. Before we go, I do want to ask you one thing. I did find a link while you were talking to stuff you'd posted about the confidence rubric. So is it cool to put a link in the show notes for that so people can track it down?
Absolutely. Is that the article for Expressia?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. That's great. Those guys build have a really good software platform and service for building customer journey maps, developing personas, and even doing some impact mapping. And okay, cool. Just great people too. So I shared that with them, however many years ago. And that's a great link to include. And I definitely recommend them.
Okay. So I'll include a link to that. I'm going to include a link to the impact mapping podcast we did way back in the day. And, if you need Scott to come do a workshop and help you figure this stuff out, he's open for business.
Yes, sir.
And hopefully we stayed on the rails enough to pass the test.
I think so, right?
I think we did too. We did pretty good. And if we didn't, it's my fault. So
no.
Well, thank you.
We can Thelma and Louise it another time.